Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening, and welcome back to Ferment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
And I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And we're your co-hosts for Ferment About It, which you can hear every week live at 7 p.m. on HeritageRadioNetwork.org or archived on HeritageRadioNetwork.org and iTunes.
We're a podcast on all things fermentable from the eyes of home brewers.
Yep.
Which includes kombucha, kimchi,
kvass.
But today we're talking about wine. Welcome to part two of Joe Pedicini. How you doing, Joe?
Doing great today. How you guys doing?
Welcome back this week. Thanks for coming back to the studio.
Thanks.
Today's episode is dedicated to my late grandfather, Sanford Ullman, and he passed away back in November. About the time his name was Sandy, and he passed away during the storm Sandy. Yep. He was 97 years old. Had a great life, and this episode is not live because I'm likely crying on Mary's shoulder down in Washington, D.C. right now. We had a nice funeral to go to today. A big party at Arlington Cemetery, 21-gun salute, and military band. Lots of fun. And anyway, this is for Sanford Ullman. I love you, dude. And but he loved wine, and we're talking about wine today. He also loved martinis, but we'll get to that in another episode. Last week we talked to Joe about his time at Deschutes. He started as a home brewer.
A home winemaker from the time he was small.
That's right.
Then went to home brewing, and then a professional brewer, and then back full circle to winemaking.
Mary, you were out getting a beer when he told me the story of how, you know, when he was actually going to get the interview at Deschutes. Is a pretty fun story. Where were you living? How did this work out, Joe? You got to tell us on the air because it's pretty good.
I was living in my tent in the Deschutes National Forest for about a week and a half. that's what you got to do when you're following your passion. You know?
Yeah. That's right. So you went in for this interview, and you know, the head brewer at the time had interviewed a couple more people. But this is before cell phones or anything else, so you had to drive down from the mountains, you know, and
make sure I had enough change for the phone at the 7-Eleven to call in to see if he had made his decision yet. You tell me, not quite yet, Joe. I'll call back tomorrow. So I had to say drat, figure out what I was going to do with my day, get back into, get some food, head back into the woods.
There you go. Awesome.
That is a great story.
Pretty good. And then a few years later, you came back to New York and then decided, after some time back, you decided you want to get into wines. So your step from there, when you decided you wanted to go into wines, you went back to Oregon?
Well, there was a bunch of sort of steps in between. There was a short period, actually, when I first left Deschutes. I came back to the East Coast here, and I was thinking about starting a brew pub in the New York area. And kind of ties into the Craft Brewers Conference, because at the time, there was, I believe, March or April, and the Craft Brewers Conference was up in Boston, and I cruised up there to, say hi to folks and see what was going on, and also look at some equipment manufacturers and see some see what my options were as far as if I was going to start this brew pub and what I had in front of me. And while I was at the conference, I ran into somebody who was starting a brewery in the Philadelphia area, and so we talked and sort of shared some similar interests. And before I knew it, again, my sort of direction had changed, and I spent a little bit of time helping this guy start a brewery down in the Philadelphia area.
Is so, that brewery still around?
Yeah, it's still down there. It's called Flying Fish.
Oh yeah.
And they make some really nice beers down in the Cherry Hill area.
Yep.
Yeah. And so after that, though, I dug up a bunch of the old winemaking equipment that was at the basement of my dad's house. And I actually breathed some new life back into the home winemaking process. And so for a few years in a row there, was in charge of making sure that friends and family had enough wine, made out of our equipment in the basement there, and sort of took it as my personal responsibility, and really had a lot of fun with it, and it introduced me to sort of some different ideas about winemaking that I wasn't exposed to when I was a kid making it with my grandparents and so forth. But there is, especially in the area where I grew up, there is a very strong culture of home winemaking. And, just about everybody that was of Italian descent in my neighborhood had a few barrels in the basement, and they had a basket press in the basement, and just about every family made wine.
What are the basics of home winemaking? Yeah. What is the equipment you say that you would need, the basic equipment, and what's the process?
You basically need a means of separating the juice from the solids.
And this is starting with grapes, not starting with, because I know, we can buy juice even, at some of our local homebrew stores, you can order it, but this is starting from grapes.
The best way to make wine is with grapes.
Yeah.
And so essentially the basically, all you have to do is separate the juice from the solids post-fermentation, put it in a barrel, make sure it's topped up and it doesn't have too much exposure to air, give it some time, and you're making wine. This is all dealing with fruit that was obviously not grown in New Jersey, so it was part of this this sort of line that's been in existence since Prohibition, where California vineyards had excess grapes that they couldn't use because they couldn't legally make the wine.
Right.
So they would transport the grapes to immigrant communities on the East Coast and sell them the grapes. And even during Prohibition, you were actually allowed to make a certain amount of wine for home consumption.
Interesting.
You're still allowed to do about 200 gallons per household.
Wow.
So
four barrels.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So take us through. So you would press the grapes. So you said you mentioned a basket press.
So yeah, and so
I've never. I mean, I've seen pictures of wine. I've been to wineries, but I've never actually
tasted it a couple of times.
But I've never made wine. So
well, so in when you're making red wine, you ferment the red wine. The basic primary fermentation is done with skin contact. So you want the juice and the skins in there commingling. And the skin is actually where most of the pigment is, and that's where you really get your color from.
Right.
Then post-fermentation, you want to separate those solids and just take the clean juice and hold that into a clean container. And it just so happens that the 60-gallon barrique is the perfect vessel for doing this because it has just the right surface area to volume ratio.
Now, what is a barrique?
A barrique is what they call it, yeah.
Oh, is it a barrel?
It's a French word for the wooden barrel that is about 220 liters.
Okay.
And it's just the right size so that over about a year, you have just the right amount of oxygen exchange to allow the wine to sort of finish what it has to do.
So if you had a smaller barrel, mm-hmm. would it take less time because of the contact area?
It might, but also a lot of the issues with the size of the barrel are more for flavor uptake. So, the smaller the barrel, the more wood influence you're going to have on the wine.
Right, because there's more surface area to
volume.
To
volume.
Yeah. And so remember that if you're going to be experimenting with your beers, they'll take on a lot of oak flavor, and maybe that's not something you're looking to do.
Yeah, because we've had friends that have had 5 gallons barrels mm-hmm. and then have had 30-35 gallon barrels.
Yeah.
And as a home brewer, either they a lot of times some of the clubs will buy a 30 or 35 gallon barrel, and then do kind of a group brew and contribute all of that to the barrel.
Yeah.
But definitely, if you're using a 5 gallon barrel, it takes a lot less time. You can get a decent amount of wood character in 2 days, for instance.
And people are doing that now too with sort of these small scale whiskey producers and. Trying to speed up the aging process.
Yes.
Which, is mixed success, I think, sometimes when you're trying to do... certain things just need time.
Yeah.
Another function of the wood flavor in whatever you're doing is the age of the barrel. And with my winemaking, what I like to do, and this is on with Monte Bruno, I like to use neutral barrels. So these are barrels that are perfectly clean and perfectly sound, but they've been used at least 5 times so that they no longer have that real kind of sweet lumberyard wood influence on the wine.
Right. So they don't contribute much flavor.
They don't contribute hardly any flavor whatsoever. Their main job is to, through the pores in the wood, allow this slow atmospheric exchange, you know, so that you have just the right amount of air uptake during the maturation.
Okay. So when you're winemaking at home, you're going to press your grapes, mm-hmm. and you said you guys would press them with a bucket press.
Well, it's called a basket press.
And what is a basket press?
I'm sure you've all seen them. It's just like this. It's a cylindrical vessel that has wooden slats going all the way around.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And they use them for apples and
okay, yeah, so cider.
Things.
Okay,
yeah.
So then you press that, and then you add the grape, you know, the skins and the juice mm-hmm. to your fermenter. And what kind of fermenter are you guys using?
So we would
at home
we would use
a carboy. You mention
a barrel with the head taken off, and then you stand it upright, and that's what you'd ferment in.
Okay.
And so what you do is actually the basket press doesn't come into play until after the fermentation. So initially, all you're doing is
fermentation.
Yeah. So what you're doing initially is you're just you have the choice of removing some of the stems if you like.
Okay.
But you can put the entire cluster in there if you'd like to, yeah.
Okay, and then you just crush them with manually.
Manually, break them up, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So and then you ferment. Now, are you guys adding yeast when you do it at home, or?
Well, as a kid, we never did.
Okay.
And now I don't commercially.
Right.
In Oregon, there's no additions whatsoever in my wine, and that's what we were talking about, sort of classifying my wine as a natural wine. It doesn't have any additives whatsoever in it, except for a very, very small amount of sulfite just before bottling. These are the same procedures that we used as a kid. You know, my parents and grandparents never used any additives in the winemaking. When I came back from sort of my brewing experiences, and when I sort of took over the family winemaking operation, for a little while there, I was experimenting with lab cultures and things like that, because that's what my background in brewing taught me was the right thing to do. And so I just found, you know, that it was very interesting and a lot of fun, but the wines produced were had a little bit less character. They had a little bit less of their own sort of interesting nuances. They sort of tasted more one-dimensional, maybe you could say.
Right.
So I kept backing off until I found myself back to square one again.
With and, adding no yeast.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Because there's enough natural yeast. I mean, if you... on the skins of the grape.
Especially if, you know, when you're using grapes that had to be on a train car, a refrigerated train car from California, and it takes a week to get to your house in New Jersey, the yeast is probably, you know, not going to be in such good shape.
Right.
But when we're harvesting in the early morning in Oregon, and we're processing that same fruit within a couple hours being harvested, it is teeming with Saccharomyces and
very fresh, like live.
Yeah, and it also, you know, it already has this sort of symbiotic relationship with the grapes that it's growing on. So it's just a natural part of the, you know, it's already there and wants to make the wine.
Right.
So it's really.
So I have a quick
how it was meant
already.
To be. Yeah.
I was at a cider pressing over the summer and they were taking the apples and actually soaking them in some star sand before actually pressing them. Would you ever do that with grapes, or would that kill all of the yeast that you wanted, or does it just would that sort of thing kill off maybe the yeast you don't want and there's still yeast in the within the skin, maybe not on the surface?
So it really is a function of how you as the winemaker or cider maker or brewer wants to handle it, you know, and if you want to have as much control over all that as you possibly can, that's one way to do it, I guess. But, you know, if you're trying to make something that, again, sort of tastes of a place rather than of a formula or a recipe, if you want it to taste of a place, then you really have to include everything that came along with it.
That's one of my favorite quotes from the last episode, actually, was you talking about, you know, how, you know, when you taste it, it takes you to that place.
Yeah.
That's why it's sought after. Yeah. And it's like,
and this
really
is true
is
not only with wines. I mean, it's true
absolutely.
With, you can't make scotch like we taste in Scotland anywhere else in the world. And you can't... These wild fermented, spontaneously fermented beers from around Brussels. That's a flavor that only exists there.
Yep, that's true. So with that, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more winemaking.
With Joe Pedicini of Montebruno Wines.
See you soon.
Ranch grass-fed beef. Pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Welcome back to Men About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We're here sitting with Joe Pedicini of Monte Bruno Wines. Monte Bruno Wines, what is Monte Bruno Wines?
It is Pinot Noir made in Oregon that is made in a way so that we do what's called non-intervention winemaking. The grapes do all the work. The wine's literally made in the vineyard. We bring in perfectly balanced sound fruit, and we carefully put it into clean fermenters and allow Mother Nature to sort of using the Saccharomyces that's already available on the grape skins themselves to ferment this beautiful Pinot Noir into wine. And then we, you know, very carefully put it into neutral barrels, bottle it unfiltered, just a small amount of sulfites added, and we feel that what we're doing is we're giving people a chance to taste the beauty of Oregon's terroir. It's a new world appellation, or you could say, it's a new world, very young wine culture in the Willamette Valley, but it has tremendous potential. And what we're trying to do is say, you know, this is Pinot Noir that tastes of the new world, but it also dances around with some old world character also.
And that's absolutely because of your full 360 to what your family was doing growing up. I mean, and when we talked about the first segment, I think that's awesome that your journey, that you're doing natural wines with an extremely informed opinion, you've gone the whole distance on everything.
Absolutely.
Now, how many winemakers in the Willamette Valley are natural winemakers?
Well, you know, we're seeing more and more. It's something that we have the ability for producing these terroir-driven wines because the from a growing standpoint, the farming in Oregon on all levels, not just with grapes, also with the hops and the barley and all types of produce, there's a real emphasis on sustainability,
mm-hmm.
and people really take it to heart.
So I think most wine consumers have never had a natural wine. I know that I went to the natural wine event at Astor Center for the first time, I think maybe 3 or 4 years ago, mm-hmm. and then we went this year.
Yeah.
And they're really, I mean, I think that's one of my favorite wine tastings that I go to. And granted, I don't go to a lot of wine tastings, but I feel it's kind of, some of the natural wines are more in tune with what I drink in beer, because they're more interesting. A lot of times they're more interesting character, and like you said, it's all about the terroir. So you're tasting, I feel like there's something more authentic about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of winemakers, especially big winemakers, really manipulate their wine.
They can, certainly. I mean, just like with brewing, you know, if you look at a catalog that is trying to sell you yeast strains,
right.
they will tell you, you know, using all these colorful adjectives about, if you use this yeast strain, you're going to have these flavors, these
right.
aromas in your final beer. The same exists in the wine business. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's people that are very concerned about getting certain points from certain publications to sell their wines,
right.
and they know that, you know, if they follow these recipes and they get they hit these sweet spots and they're going to get the points, and these manufacturers of barrels and of yeast strains and of malolactic cultures, they're all telling them that, you know, yeah, buy our stuff and we'll get you that sweet spot,
right.
And what I feel is that the people that like my wine, their sweet spot is something completely different,
right.
and
yeah.
that's kind of, I feel my production is so small, I'm not trying to please everybody, and I'm not trying to get everybody to drink my wine. I'm just saying that I know that there's enough people out there, people that that appreciate food producers that do things on a small scale, very much quality driven. There's plenty of people out there to support winemakers and food producers and restaurateurs beer makers that sort of have that approach.
Yeah, and I think part of it is just education, people knowing about what natural wines means and what you're doing in Oregon to get, you know, this sense of place, like you said.
I think another thing that comes around, too, is when you're tasting a lot of wine or tasting a lot of beer, it can have, you can get fatigued after a while.
Yeah.
And I think that another point with natural wine is, for the most part, in general, the alcohol levels are a little bit lower, and the fact that there's less additives and there's a lot less sulfites is easier on the body.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important, too, because... you guys are very young, but I'm getting older.
I mean, I'm feeling
probably not as young as you think.
I don't know. We have a face for radio.
It's a more healthy product, is what I'm trying to say.
And natural wine, it's a more natural product. I love that I can go and buy a bottle of your wine and taste, you know, Willamette Valley as it was meant to be, with almost no manipulation, with natural yeast, with grapes as they were meant to be.
Right. That's what we're trying to do. So you're not tasting, the oak of a particular forest in France. You're tasting grapes from Willamette Valley in Oregon.
Right, and the natural yeasts and what those two combinations, you know, create. So that's fantastic.
And soil also. Soil is incredible.
Weather.
That's what we talk about when we're speaking of terroir. Is sort of the culmination of the sun, the wind, the rain, the soil. The microorganisms in the soil, the amount of heat you get, these things are all factors.
Speaking of temperature, how important is temperature control during wine fermentation?
That's a good question.
It's really important. I think that we're blessed in the Willamette Valley, where we're usually harvesting towards the end of October, and it's pretty cold. So I don't have problems with fermentations getting too hot. And I think with winemaking, to me, that's problematic, because some people intentionally bring up their temperature of their fermenters because they get better extraction and they get more color and they get maybe some more intense flavors. But I think what happens is it blows off a lot of the more subtle, nuanced, aromatic properties in wine.
Because you're getting such a vigorous fermentation.
And a lot of that stuff is sort of volatile, or sort of fleeting as it is, and so when you heat things up and you're kind of you have a more aggressive fermentation, a lot more CO2 being generated, you're kind of chasing some of these more pretty nuanced flavors, I think, out of the wine. And I mean, that might sound kind of silly, but that's sort of my approach to things. I like the subtle red fruit and sort of like the floral character that you have in a wine that fermented maybe closer to 75 degrees or so, never hit 90s.
Right. Well, when would a yeast be dying or throwing off? What?
I've seen fermenters go up to mid 90s without any problems.
You spoke about when you age, you want that atmospheric kind of exchange going on. How about oxidation and wine?
Well, it's a delicate balance with you want just enough air but not too much. So you don't want to be in an oxidative state, but if you have no air whatsoever in winemaking, you can fall into what's called a reductive state, and that is as bad as being oxidized.
What happens in a reductive state, flavor-wise?
Well, some pretty funky flavors and aromas can arise, and to the point where you can get some things like mercaptans that are almost impossible to get rid of.
Oh, that's a skunky, right? It come across as
rotten
kind of
egg
skunky,
and
rotten egg,
rubbery and nasty
sulfur,
stuff like that. Yeah.
So if you don't age with that atmospheric exchange, that can happen.
Yes, So it's,
but once it goes into a bottle, it's not subject to that at all, because
it's a function of giving enough time to take up what it needs, and then in theory, when it goes into bottle, it's at a balanced state.
Right.
So
and your primary fermenters, so there's no. is there an airlock on those?
They're
open top. That's my question. Yeah. And what are you fermenting in your primary fermentation?
Stainless.
In stainless.
Yeah. And what we
open
do
top
is we
stainless. Interesting.
Open top stainless, and we go in and if we're doing whole clusters, sometimes we actually have to go in and do a little foot treading to soften things up and get a little bit of the juices flowing. If if there is enough if there's enough juice in the fermenter, we can actually just do punch downs by hand or with a small handheld punch down tool. But we don't do pump overs. We feel they're kind of aggressive, and we don't do
what is a pump over?
Yeah,
a pump over is just simply where you're pulling juice off the bottom of the fermenter and pumping it back over the top.
Because that causes what you're like doing more is, compression, basically?
You're trying to keep
sucking from the bottom.
You're trying to keep that surface area wet.
Okay.
And you're trying to reduce the exposure to too much aerobic activity on the surface.
Okay, right.
So again, also a lot of folks are doing these pump overs because they feel that it's aiding their extraction.
Okay.
And I just kind of like the idea that the just like in the barrels, in the fermenter, the actively fermenting wine kind of takes on this it takes on this sort of life where there's stratus layers. Mm-hmm. And they're there for reasons, and you shouldn't really mess with them too much.
Right.
And, especially those lower couple of layers.
Oh, so people are doing pump overs as it's during the entire process.
Yeah, like on a daily basis.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah.
And so I feel that, especially on the towards the bottom of the fermenter, there's some things that settle down that we want to keep at the bottom.
Right.
I take that. So we were talking just before we started about natural wines, and when we went to this tasting, we saw a couple pictures of a couple people, their fermenters. You're doing
in
stainless
Europe.
Steel,
mm-hmm.
and a couple of other people were using actually concrete fermenters. And if I'm a handy home brewer, and I want to make a little 5-gallon, and I don't want to use a better bottle or glass, and is there a reason why I shouldn't or? Is there a reason
why
we're not
using alternative fermentation containers? I mean, as homebrewers, we either use glass carboys,
yeah.
stainless steel, or now better bottles. But wine makers,
stainless steel is really expensive.
Yeah,
better bottles are good, but they're plastic, and,
right.
and they're
they can scratch.
There's a lifeline on there's a
so what
a
else?
Lifespan,
I mean,
and glass can break and
I mean, I think there's a whole world of options. It's just a question of how you keep things clean after your fermentation, and how do you sanitize before you're bringing your next brew in. But I think there's something that has been used for probably more than 5,000 years to make wine. It's called an amphora, and it's a ceramic vessel that's mm-hmm. shaped kind of like a vase. Ceramic,
which you can see in the Natural History Museum.
Yes. And I'm sure that ceramic has been used for fermentation,
yes.
for fermenting beers.
Absolutely.
I also know for a fact that Samuel Smith Brewery used to use what they called Yorkshire slates, and they were these kind of bluestone square open-top fermenters that they used for their primary fermentations.
Yeah.
So with your experience in brewing, is there a reason why I should not construct myself a cement fermenter?
You might be asking the wrong guy, but I would... I would say play around with it. I mean, I'd say do it. I have a friend out in the Bend area, Paul Arney. He's got a brewery that he just started called Saheli, and he's doing all kinds of crazy things with, he has built his own mash tun out of a carved log, and he's
awesome.
Really beautiful thing, and the beers are wonderful.
Yeah.
He's doing fermenting in Oregon oak barrels, and just having a lot of fun.
That's great.
Making really nice beers.
Where can
so
we find
experiment?
Your,
yeah. Where can you? I
where
have
can
two
we
questions.
Find your wines in the country
in the New York
or,
City area?
Yeah, how many states are you in? And in New York City.
Well, I mean, our production is real small. We're only at about 1,000 cases a year.
Ah.
So, but we're blessed with a great distributor here in New York called Jenny and Francois Selections, and they've done a real good job of getting our wine into some really good restaurants, but also some nice retail shops that.
And Astor, I assume, since they definitely have your wine.
They do, and they have a wonderful, knowledgeable staff there, and
a
wonderful place to shop.
So I have two questions. Mm-hmm. One, would you ever consider serving or packaging your wine in kegs so that it can be served on tap?
So I think I'm not opposed to that. I think it's a great idea because it's from a sustainability standpoint, it makes
right.
a lot of sense. My Pinot Noirs that I make at this point in time are meant to age for 10 or more years in the cellar, so it's not really a perfect vessel for that.
Right.
But for some other more simple reds or even some whites for drinking in the short term, I think it's a great idea.
And that leads to my second question. Are you considering other styles of wine or other grapes?
Yeah, I mean, the real passion is with Pinot Noir, but I also love many other grapes, too. And we have to get some whites back into the program. In the early days, I made a little bit of Pinot Blanc and a little Gewurztraminer, and some friends that tried that wine keep on reminding me that I have to make more.
Good. Well, we look forward to you know, having your Pinot Noirs and then keeping
absolutely
in touch with you.
And I look forward to brewing with you at 508.
Yeah. Let's
do it. It's
going to
be very fun. And,
I think that'd be a trip. Yeah.
That's going to be awesome. Yeah. And Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey,
Joe Pettisini, Montreux Wines.
Thanks for having me on, you guys. Really appreciate it. It's fun talking with you.
And we'll put links on our website either tonight or probably tomorrow while I'm in the bus to D.C.
And by that, we mean last week for the listeners this week, because it's April 1st when you're hearing me talk right now. But whoop, I'm future man because I'm recording this today.
But we'll have all the links on our website. We've caught up. Also, we want to just tell you we're very grateful for the folks at Heritage Radio Network. We're extremely happy to be part of the Heritage Radio Network family. There's over 30 shows. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on. And it is a not-for-profit, so they need your support. And if you guys like the show, if you like some of the other shows, we would invite you to become a member. Membership starts as low as $25 for student and goes up. The basic membership is only $60. Anyway, please go to heritageradionetwork.org to you know, browse all the shows and learn more about becoming a member. You get discounts at both Brooklyn Homebrew and Bitter Nesters and
Jimmy's
number
43.
So thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with a recap of our Craft Brewers Conference with probably some interviews and clips. And we look forward to talking to you then.
That's right.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.